Bible uses different terms to describe Christians. Christians are saints. The emphasis there being on our set apartness. We have been set apart for God. Christians are disciples. The emphasis there being on learning, being students of this great teacher, Jesus Christ. Christians are the elect. The emphasis there on privilege, the privilege of being singled out for favour. So those are some of the terms that the Bible uses. But in this passage that we're looking at this morning, we have another one. This one is found on the lips of Jesus. It occurs three times here, and it's the term little ones. Little ones. It's there in verse 6, it's there in verse 10, and it's there in verse 14. Christians, this passage says, are little ones. And what then is the emphasis with this biblical description? Well, I want to answer that question this morning in two ways. First of all, it emphasizes lowliness. This description, Christians are little ones, it emphasizes lowliness. So the passage begins with this question from the disciples: who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? There's a word that the ESV misses out. The question is actually, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Which suggests that something has prompted them to ask this. Perhaps it's a combination of things. There has been the prophecy concerning Peter: on this rock I will build my church. There has been the selection of Peter, James, and John to accompany Jesus up that high mountain. There has been the recent incident in Capernaum, those taxmen treating Peter as the official go-to when it comes to Jesus' tax arrangements. There has been the inability of 9 disciples to cast out a demon in a young boy. And so when they ask this question here in verse 1, the disciples are saying, what does all this mean in terms of our rankings, in terms of how we rate in relation to each other? Does it mean then that Peter is in pole position amongst us, followed closely by James and John? Does it mean that the failed exorcists in the group are also rams, hopelessly adrift from the leading pack? Who then, they are saying, in the light of everything that's just been going on, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And it's a big deal to them, this. It's not that conversation between them and Jesus is flagging, and so they come up with this question simply to avert an awkward silence or something. No, they approach Jesus with this question. At that time, the disciples came to him saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? This is clearly a matter of great importance to them. And I think we can easily miss how strong Jesus' response is to the question in verse 3. We immediately latch on to the become like children bit. But just omit those words for a minute. What does the verse then say? Truly I say to you, unless you turn, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. That's a phenomenally strong statement Jesus makes. He's saying that attitude that you disciples have just expressed in your question, that concern for status and kudos, that is so incompatible with being a Christian that if you don't turn from it, it indicates you're unsaved and will not, at the end of the age, enter the kingdom of heaven. That's what Jesus is saying. Why? Why does he say that? Why is a concern for status and kudos so incompatible with being a Christian? Well, because Christians are by definition little ones. And Jesus illustrates this point then by exhibiting in verse 2 a literal little one, a child. And we need to understand exactly what he's doing here. He's not highlighting some virtue that children possess, humility or self-effacement or something like that. Children are from conception sinful, Psalm 51 tells us. They're not characterized by virtues. Rather, he's highlighting an objective status that children possess. In that cultural context, at least, children were lowly. They very much played second fiddle to adults. Adults had the limelight, children were in the background. And Jesus is saying then what's true of literal little ones is also true of little ones in this other sense, Christians. Christians, like children in the ancient world, have this objective status. They are lowly. They play second fiddle. They are in the background. How is that so? In a sociological sense, the Christians always have to be bottom of the ladder in society. Never leaders, never CEOs, never prime ministers. No, not in a sociological sense. In this sense. What has Jesus just emphasized in the previous section, there in the last few verses of chapter 17? Well, he has emphasized that he is the Son of God. Do you remember that? Remember, there was that tax that every Israelite for centuries had had to pay, and he didn't have to pay because he's the Son of the God to whom the tax is due. And we commented last week on what an extraordinary thing that is. Sadly, it can become trite and old hat to us, perhaps especially at Christmas time. It can become trite and old hat to us that Jesus is the Son of God. But it's not trite. It's not old hat. It's stunning. An awesome truth is the phrase that we used last week. And what is a Christian then? Well, a Christian is someone who, in the face of that reality, in the face of the reality of divine sonship, exclaims, "Wow, wow, Jesus Christ is colossally great. He deserves all the praise and all the glory." A Christian is someone who says, "I am nothing. He is everything. May I decrease. May he increase. He is supreme. He is preeminent. He is all surpassing. I'm just a little one who wants for time and for eternity to be in the background, playing second fiddle to him, a lowly light bulb in a floodlight that illuminates this magnificent Son of God." That's a Christian. Remember those words of the physicist Sir Isaac Newton at the end of his epoch-making scientific career? He said, "I do not know what I may appear to the world, but to myself I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself in now and then finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me." And a Christian is similarly a boy, a little one, standing on the shore, gazing adoringly at this great ocean that utterly dwarfs him, the glory of Jesus Christ. And do you see now why the disciples' attitude here is so incompatible then with being a Christian? Imagine you go to a concert and you watch one of the world's greatest pianists play some very elaborate, complex piece of music. And it's a wonderful experience. And driving home from the concert, you're in a kind of rapture. You've been so entranced by this performance. But then your passengers in the car who have been at the concert with you and have some elementary piano skills themselves, they get into an acrimonious exchange about which of them can do a better rendition of Jingle Bells. I mean, you'd be baffled by that, wouldn't you? You'd feel like stopping the car and saying, "Were you really at that concert? Did you go to the toilet and never manage to find your way back to your seats or something? Did someone spike your drinks so that you fell into a coma? that awesome musician reduced us all to little pygmies by comparison who can barely string two notes together. How can you then think of claiming musical superiority over each other? How don't such claims seem stupidly crass and irrelevant to you? Look, guys, there's something impossibly incongruous and contradictory about your behavior here. And that's what Jesus is saying to these men. He's saying there's something impossibly incongruous and contradictory about those who have been reduced to little pygmies, bowed in wonder, love, and praise at my feet, then being concerned as to which of them is the greatest. It just doesn't fit. You must turn, he says. You must turn from such behavior. And so must we, if there's anything of that at all in us. If this morning we want to be eminent Christians, leading Christians, those looked up to as somebodies by our fellow believers, it should not be. We are little ones. What defines us is that recognition that Jesus is big, I am small. Jesus is the Son of God, I am his humble worshipper. And surely then from that should flow the deepest indifference as to our status and kudos within the church. And so that's the first thing then about this phrase, little ones, this description of Christians. It emphasizes lowliness. But then notice with me secondly this morning, it emphasizes fragility. It emphasizes fragility. There's been a lot of attention in recent months on plastics and the detrimental effect that plastics are having on our natural environment, particularly the damage they're doing to wildlife, both in the oceans and on the land. One example that often comes up is beer can rings. So in multi-packs of beer, the four or maybe six individual cans are held together by these plastic rings, and they apparently cause lots of problems. There's a woman in York who describes herself as a wild hedgehog rehabilitator. And on her website, then, you can see images of hapless hedgehogs ensnared by these beer can rings. Now, I should think that not one of us in this room has ever been ensnared by a beer can ring. We've probably walked on paths where beer can rings have lain, but instead of being remotely imperiled by them, we've just trodden on the flimsy things without even noticing them and continued on our way. So why then are they such a threat to hedgehogs? Well, of course, because hedgehogs are little. And because they are little, they are fragile, and they are easily harmed. And when Jesus in this passage talks about Christians as little ones, yes, he means on the one hand that they are lowly and the last people on earth who should be concerned about status and kudos, but he also means that they are fragile and easily harmed. Look at verse 7. Verse 7 begins, "Woe to the world for temptations to sin," which sounds as though Jesus is strongly condemning the world. But I don't think that's the case. The word translated woe, it has two possible meanings. So yes, it can be an expression of condemnation, and often it functions in that way from the lips of Jesus, and that in fact is how it functions in the second half of verse 7. But it can also be an expression of sympathy. So in chapter 24 verse 19, Jesus is talking about the forthcoming destruction of Jerusalem, and he says there, "Alas for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days." But it's the same Greek word, alas, there, that's translated in our text, woe. Now clearly there in that verse, Jesus isn't against the pregnant and breastfeeding mothers. The point is, he's concerned for them. He's concerned as to what's going to become of them when the Roman armies storm the city of Jerusalem. So the ESV is right in its translation at alas rather than woe. And I think the meaning here in the first half of verse 7 is similar. I think, too, that temptations to sin is a bit too specific there. You can see from the footnote that it's literally stumbling blocks. So what is Jesus saying in that line? Well, in the same way that that woman in York might see beer can rings and other items of rubbish lying on the ground and might exclaim, "Alas, the world is so full of stumbling blocks for fragile little hedgehogs." So Jesus here is lamenting, "Alas, the world is so full of stumbling blocks for fragile little disciples of mine." That's the point. That's the meaning of those words in verse 7. And I'm sure that for most of us who are Christians here this morning, this second emphasis then in the phrase, little ones, this emphasis on fragility, I'm sure it resonates with us. I'm sure we feel often like little ones, like pathetic, vulnerable, breakable Christians surrounded by deadly perils. And Jesus, in these verses then, he doesn't have some formula for becoming less fragile, for beefing ourselves up a bit, for upgrading from hedgehogs to elephants who won't be so easily ensnared. No, he assumes that fragility is normal. That as long as we are alive in this world as his disciples, we will be little ones. In other words, we're not to try to alter that reality. Instead, we are to live in the light of that reality. And according to Jesus, that means at least two things. First of all, it means we must be careful not to destroy others. We must be careful not to destroy others. All Christians you know are little ones. All Christians you know in this church are little ones. And that means you must be careful around them. If I'm picking up at Fraser from school, I have to walk across the yard where there are lots of children excited that it's the end of the school day and are charging around. And I'm conscious then that if I just march across there, I'm likely to send several of them flying. I have to proceed carefully, stopping sometimes, altering my course sometimes. And in the Church of Jesus Christ, you're in a place where you can easily send people flying. Because you're surrounded by little ones. You have to proceed carefully. And so Jesus talks in verse 6 about causing one of these little ones to sin. But again, I think that's too narrow. It's to stumble. And in verse 7 about one by whom stumbling comes. So how does this happen then? How does one Christian cause another to stumble? Well, it can be by causing a fellow believer to sin, as the ESV renderings have it here. And we've seen that recently in our evening sermons, haven't we, in 1 Corinthians. The way in which you can put pressure on a Christian to do something that he or she believes is wrong so that that person does it despite believing that it is wrong. And they do it thinking that they are defying Christ, and so they are defying Christ, and it can be the start of a trajectory that leads someone right away from Christ. So yes, causing someone to stumble can be specifically causing them to sin in that way. But you can cause someone to stumble in other ways, just by treating a person unlovingly. It's no coincidence that Jesus will go on soon to talk about unforgiving attitudes. It's a plain fact, is it not, that there are people out there today who once were professing Christians and who are no longer professing Christians. And it was the unforgiving attitude of Christians that caused them to start to turn away. Or perhaps not just an unforgiving attitude, but an unloving attitude generally. It was backbiting that they encountered in the church. It was gossiping that they encountered in the church. It was impatient attitudes toward one another. It was envy that they encountered in the church. It was those things that caused them to start to turn away. Unloving behavior caused them to stumble. We all need to be really careful. And Jesus is emphatic, isn't he, about how seriously God takes it when someone does cause another Christian to stumble. You see, there's an important tension here. We said in our first point this morning that to be a Christian is by definition to be someone who says, I must decrease, he must increase. A Christian is a self-abasing worshipper. Simple as that. And that's true. But that can then spill over into the idea that Christians therefore mean nothing to God. They're just his light bulbs that floodlight his and his son's glory. And that's not true. That's not true. Christians aren't nothing to God. On the contrary, Christians are incalculably valued by God. And that little one then, in my church, whom I could potentially destroy by my unforgiving or generally unloving behavior, that Christian is incalculably valued by God. That's the point of verses 10 to 14. The value of Christians to God is brought out there in two ways. First, Jesus says that God devotes his angels to their safekeeping. Each individual Christian has the safekeeping of the angels devoted to him or her. That's the point of verse 10. The point is not that each Christian has one specific guardian angel. It's angels in the plural. So the point is that every Christian has all the angels, myriad angels devoted to his or her protection and safekeeping. It's the same point as Psalm 91, that he will send his angels to lift you up in their hands when you're in difficulty. It's Hebrews 1:14 that the angels are ministering spirits sent to serve on behalf of those who will inherit salvation. And this picture of them kind of looking into the face of God then, I think it's the idea of they are there in heaven eagerly watching God for him to just give them the signal so that they will come swooping down to protect and help some Christian on earth. So that's one indication of the value of the Christian in the eyes of God. He has all these angels on standby, all these angels waiting to come to their help and their aid. And then the second thing, the second way it's brought out is this: in case the idea of dispatching angels seems too cold, we have this other picture of God himself, like an anxious shepherd, going after the individual Christian who has gotten into trouble. Now, perhaps your cogs are turning at this point, and you're thinking in this way: well, if God values so much the individual believer and is so protective toward the individual believer and has angels on standby and is himself a shepherd who will go after the individual believer, then surely that lessens my responsibility to be careful around my fellow believers. God will see to their protection. I don't need to be too bothered about it. And of course, there are other passages in the New Testament which use this same theology of God's protectiveness toward individual believers to make precisely that point, that God will hold us fast. God will keep those who are his own. That's not the point here. The point here is that if God values individual Christians so much as to have angels on standby, as to be a shepherd toward them, he's not going to take kindly to, he's not going to treat lightly a Christian who comes along and causes another to stumble. That's the point. We're not meant to read verse 14. It is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. We're not meant to read that verse and say, well, that's wonderful then. Because God's will is invincible. So if he wills that none of his will perish, none of them will perish. That's true. And that's the truth emphasized elsewhere. That's not how we're meant to read this verse. Rather, we're meant to read verse 14 and say, wow, if it's God's will that none of his little ones should perish, I better make sure I'm not the instrument of one of them perishing. I better make sure that I'm not a stumbling block to someone God values so highly. Verse 6 is scary, isn't it? Where Jesus basically says, what awaits the one who causes another Christian to stumble is a judgment alongside of which the worst fate men can imagine seems puny and inconsequential. Being drowned by a millstone is the worst form of torture in the ancient world. And yet that's vastly preferable, Jesus says, vastly preferable to the judgment that awaits a Christian who has caused Christians to stumble. So as I say, we all need to be careful. Are you mindful that each of your fellow Christians is a little one, vulnerable to the metaphorical beer can rings that we might leave around the place? Let's be protective of each other. Let's receive each other in the language of verse 5. Is that a verb that applies well to your relations with your brothers and sisters this morning? You're receiving them, not repelling them, not pushing them away from yourself and from Christ, but embracing, receiving. We must be careful not to destroy others. But then the second implication of this, if we're little ones, if we're fragile, yes, it means we must be careful not to destroy others, but it also means we must be careful not to destroy ourselves. We must be careful not to destroy ourselves. Our fragility carries that possibility, and hence we have verses 8 and 9, where Jesus is saying then that sin can get into our lives and can destroy us because of this fragility, because we are not supermen and superwomen. And so Jesus says very strikingly in those verses that to prevent that sort of destruction, we have to engage in destruction. That's what Jesus says in those verses. So that we will not be destroyed, we have to destroy those areas of our lives where sin is getting in. That's what he says. And so he talks, doesn't he, about three different areas. Let's work backwards. He talks about eyes there in verse 9. So sin then can get into our lives through the stuff we look at, through the stuff we watch. And if that's the case then, Jesus says, destroy that possibility. Not literally rip out your eyes, but destroy the possibility of sin getting into you and destroying you by that route. Whatever that means practically, whether it means not going online ever again in your life, whether it means getting rid of some device, a television, whatever it might be, whether it means changing your route to work in the morning, avoid sin getting in through that particular channel. And then he talks about feet. So sin can get in through where we go. I think that's the point there. I mean, that applies very much to those Corinthians we've been considering on Sunday evenings. The problem was they were going with their feet down the street and into the idol temples. And Paul doesn't say, well, you know, when you're in the idol temples, make sure you're careful not to engage in idolatry. No, he says, don't go to the idol temples. So destroy that whole area of your life where sin is getting in. And if there's a venue in your life, if there's a place in your life, if there's a location in your life, if your feet are taking you somewhere or your car is taking you somewhere where sin is getting in, then remove that area, that venue, that place, that location from your life. Destroy it, Jesus is saying. He talks about hands. So perhaps there, as is often the case in the Bible, hands stand for kind of the grasping thing, grasping after stuff, grasping after possessions, grasping after treasure. And Jesus is saying then, if sin is getting in through money, through possessions, through that whole side of life, then take drastic action. He says to one man, doesn't he, that you can't be a disciple of mine unless you sell everything you have. Why does he say that to him? Is that a universal requirement? You can't be a disciple of Jesus unless you sell everything? Well, no. Most people don't have to sell everything when they become a disciple. That man had to sell everything. Why? Because otherwise sin getting in through that area of his life would destroy him and destroy his discipleship. Take drastic action. And so we need to beware then, not just destroying little ones around us, but destroying ourselves. We can think of ourselves as stronger and more robust than we are. We can think of ourselves as able to resist things when we can't. And so Jesus is saying, because you're a little one, make sure that you don't destroy yourself by the sin you allow into your life. Engage in this limited destruction, that the destruction of your whole self in hell will not occur. And so this morning then, let's take these realities seriously. Let's ponder this description that perhaps we don't ponder very often of ourselves, that we are little ones. Remember, and it emphasizes our lowliness. If there's any ambition for status within the Christian church that's there within us, let's remind ourselves we're little ones who are there to adore and worship the Son of God. And we are little ones in the sense of being fragile. So watch out for each other and watch out for yourself. May God bless his word to us. Amen.